Well, didn't the text line love that track? Walk the Dinosaur was, not was, James has written Miff, absolute banger of a tune on the text line. And, well, it was created by my next guest who was responsible for that track, who also produced this song. And guess what? He's the president as well of one of the world's most prestige jazz labels, and I can assure you, you will have a Blue Note record in your collection somewhere. They're so beautifully designed, but they released so many records and continue to do so today. Miles Davis was on it.
So many.
Don Was is my guest. He's here. Hello.
Doing? It's a real honor to be here with you.
And it's not even 1% of what you've done in your life and career, mentioning those three things.
Yeah.
How on earth have you managed to find the time to do what you've done? I was about to say you've produced 7 Rolling Stones records. You've worked with Elton John, Bob Dylan, Willie Nelson, Roy Orbison, Bonnie Raitt. We're not worthy, Don. Is that okay to say?
Well, it's amazing what you can do if you don't sleep, you know.
Yeah, is that the key, is it?
No, it's not the case. Don't try that at home. No. It doesn't work, yeah.
When you come to Australia for a visit, do you scout for new talent for Blue Note? Is that the point?
Well, we actually are. You know, we're going to launch a series of anthologies of Australian jazz because there's some really great music here, and I'm getting turned on to it. And I know you are a respected music journalist, and if you can think of anybody, turn me on to them.
I will for sure.
We're going to come back and start doing that. There's great music here, and we should spread it to the rest of the world.
Absolutely. You took over Blue Note Records back in 2012, I think, around about that time.
Uh-huh.
And I think it is safe to say one of the most influential jazz labels in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's been going for 80 years.
80 years, yeah.
How did you decide, with all of your experience, your wealth of experience in many fields, including documentary film too, which we'll get to, how did you decide that that job was the next step as president of Blue Note for an already diverse musical life?
Well, it was an accident, really. I was in New York. I was producing John Mayer's album called Born and Raised, and we had one night off, and I picked up the Village Voice just to see what was going on, and I saw that a singer who I really dug, who was just getting started, had put out one record on an independent label. A guy named Gregory Porter was appearing at a tiny club up on the Upper West Side near Harlem called Smoke. So I went up there to catch his show, and he was awesome. It was one of the best shows I'd seen in decades. You know? So the next morning, I was having breakfast with an old buddy of mine who I knew when he was the drummer with Lloyd Cole and the Commotions. But he'd become the president of Capitol Records, a guy named Dan McCarroll. And I said, is Blue Note Records still part of Capital? Because if it is, you should sign this guy I saw last night. And he said, no, you should sign him. And it turns out they were looking for someone to head up the company. Bruce Lundvall, who had run Blue Note for 30 years, was retiring. And they were looking for someone who understood the ethos of the company, the aesthetic that had made the music of the previous 70 years relevant in every decade. How do you do that, right? But also understood how to take it forward. And just by virtue of coming in with an idea about Gregory Porter, I was offered the gig. But I didn't, I'd spent my life trying to not have a job. That was really my goal.
Yeah, you're living the dream, Don Was.
But it worked out all right. Yeah,
and now you got a job.
No, I
and
got
you've
a job,
kept
man.
It.
Yeah, that's
how even do you, more. How do you steer jazz into the future and keep that legacy intact?
Well, when we really went back to look at the legacy of Blue Note Records, it was that the artists in every era, whether it's Thelonious Monk in 1948 or Art Blakey in the early 50s or Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock and Ornette Coleman in the 60s or even Robert Glasper today, they all were artists who absorbed the foundations of music that preceded them but learned to take it and make something brand new going forward. They all pushed the boundaries of music. So if that's your music.
And culture, I would say.
Oh, it impacts.
Not just music.
It had a
huge cultural impact.
Everything about Blue Note has, not beyond the music, even if you look at the graphics from the great 1950s and 60s records, all the covers were designed by a guy named Reed Miles, who I think did an amazing job of taking music and turning it into an iconic graphic. And the style that he created for the Blue Note album covers has really permeated the whole vocabulary of graphic design for decades to come. I mean, you see it on ads for, you know, shoes.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's incredible.
Yeah. It is incredible. You always come back to jazz, and now that you mention those record companies, record covers, tell me about that little kid who grew up in Detroit who used to catch the bus to just go to a record store to have a look at these records and pore over them as a little kid with big dreams. Take me back to that.
Well, I loved the music so much. I didn't really know much about jazz. But one day I was driving around with my mom. She was running errands, and she was dragging me along with her, and I was just being kind of a hostile shopper. So she left me in the car with the keys, right? And I was playing with the radio.
Remember when they used to leave us in the car? No, yes, yeah, it's a very different time.
They should have called Department of Social Services on her immediately. But thankfully, she left me in the car with the keys, and I found the Detroit Jazz Station, and I heard a song that I later learned was called Mode for Joe by a guy named Joe Henderson, and I landed on the station just as he was beginning the saxophone solo, and what I heard was not saxophone solo or saxophone music, but I heard anguished cries, like going, that's what it sounds like. You know? Yeah. And I could relate to it. It was exactly how I felt, getting dragged around by my mom all day, right? And I thought, this music is speaking to me. But as soon as the drummer kicked in, he sort of fell in line and started swinging. And the message that came through was, Don, you got to groove in the face of adversity, okay? And I was like, I was blown away that music that didn't have lyrics could speak to me like that, number one. And number two, just that because the whole thing sounded so cool and felt so cool, it completely changed my mood and took me from a negative place to a very positive frame of mind. When my mom got back in the car, I was a nice kid again. But it really stayed with me that this music could have that kind of impact on you. So I started collecting records and love the covers, love the black and white photos on the back, love the liner notes. And there's a whole culture around Blue Note. And it's been a really important part of my life ever since.
Don Was is my guest, and we're talking about his pretty extraordinary musical career and professional career. Detroit was where you grew up, Motor City. We know it as the home of Motown soul, but it was a lot more than that. It was punk rock and roll. It was a whole bunch of sounds. How much of that music and growing up in Detroit impacted on the musician you became? Because you're an amazing bass player.
Thank you very
yourself.
Much. Wasn't looking for that, but thank you.
but also, you grabbed from so many different styles. I mean, listening to Was Not Was then, that was a totally different experience to what we hear that your musical influences were.
Well, the Detroit I grew up in, which was in the 1950s and 1960s, was truly the Motor City. And all these factories popped up after World War II, and people came from all over the world to find jobs there. And they brought their cultures with them. Food, clothes, and their music. So I grew up listening to everything. And there's also something about a place where the economy is based around one industry. So my parents were both teachers, for example. But if auto sales were down, they'd lay off workers. Workers would move away to another city. So then they'd lay off teachers because the students left. And they'd lay off barbers and they'd lay off, you know, waitresses. So everybody was kind of in the same boat, and there wasn't much point in putting on any airs in Detroit. No point in, like, driving around in a limo or anything because everyone knew we were all in the same boat. And that makes for a very honest city and some people who just don't take any crap, you know? And I think you can hear it in the music. To me, John Lee Hooker is the epitome of Detroit music. Yeah. It's very raw, but so soulful.
Absolutely.
He's my favorite you know, electric blues guy like the MC5 and the Stooges. I grew up listening to that. Same thing.
There's a rumor that MC5, the Stooges, Bob Seger, and Parliament played at your high school.
Bob Seger played at my high school. The Stooges played at the high school next to me.
What was going on in Detroit high schools when you were growing up?
They were local bands, yeah, and they were just local bands. Funkadelic, they were called the Parliaments back then, a five-piece vocal group, and they came to my junior high school. It was probably 1965, and we had a sock hop, which is where you go into the gym and take your shoes off and you dance in your socks.
Cute.
And they were plugging their new single, I Just Want to Testify, and they came and performed that there. That's a
that
trip.
Must have blown your mind.
Well, at the time, it was just, you kind of took it for granted. But looking back on it, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, it was a rich cultural environment to grow up in, and I'm really grateful that I had that upbringing.
You saw the Rolling Stones age 12,
yep.
And later on in life you produced 7 Rolling Stones records.
That could be true, yes.
Yes. This is obviously beyond a working relationship now. It's professional and personal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure.
Tell us, how do you work with a band like that, of the stature of the Stones, and also keep pushing each other and looking for new ways to move forward?
Well, that's a very good question. It's actually quite easy because they're really good.
Yeah.
There's never any kind of struggle in the studio to make it good. There's a reason that they've endured for so long. I think it's probably closing in on 60 years now, right?
Yes.
And that just has to do with the nature of the way they play, which, by the way, is very similar to a jazz group. They listen to each other intently. There's a it's a conversation.
I always think of Charlie Watts as a jazz drummer.
Charlie Watts is a jazz drummer.
Yeah, he is a jazz drummer,
yes.
Isn't he? Yeah.
And he plays like that. And he'll just do, like, it'll be nuanced. He'll play a little figure on a hi-hat, but Keith Richards will hear that, and he'll play something in response to that, and that'll change the way the mix sings. That'll give Ronnie something to play off of. So it's a conversation that's going on, and they're really, really good at it, and they're really well-suited to playing together. I've played bass with them on a number of occasions, and it's fun. It's jocular. The conversation is loose and easy and fun. And I think that comes through in the music.
Yeah.
And I think that's they're just a great band. So it's really kind of easy.
Yeah. I'm really interested to know what you're attracted to musically. You've worked with so many people. And I think about the B-52s, who we played, Love Shack.
Yeah,
you produced that record. And that song is probably played at every single 18th, 21st, 50th. It crosses generations, it crosses genres, and really at the time in the 80s it was quite a kooky thing, that band doing the 60s thing in the 1980s. And yet you were attracted to that band and working with that band. What makes you go, I'm going to work with that group? Is what's that bit of magic?
The magic is storytelling. You know, you actually don't even have to have words to tell the story, but someone's got to dig deep down inside emotionally and find something deep inside of them and want to communicate that to another person. And you do it artistically. It could be a painting, you know, it could be a poem, it could be recorded music. But the idea is to communicate to someone and give them something to help them make sense out of their own inner emotional lives and the complexities of just being a human being. It's not easy, you know? I mean, we don't know why we're here. We don't know if we're going to die in the next 10 seconds. We don't know if we're going to get fired. We don't know if we're going to get divorced. Life is crazy. And anything that kind of helps you feel grounded and remember who you are, that's got great value. And that's what I'm interested in. The style of singing makes no difference. So I've produced country artists or jazz artists or rock and roll. Take a song like Love Shack. That was a first take. They didn't even finish writing it. We just sort of organized it like 2 minutes before we cut the song. It was the first take. And something happened there's a break right at the end where the band stops and Cindy goes, "Your tin roof rusted." And she was so emotional. I don't even know what the line means. No one does. You know?
I'm glad to know that the producer of that song doesn't know what that means either.
Knew. It was just a thing. But if you listen to it, what happened in the room was it's only lasts maybe 3 seconds or something. But in the course of that 3 seconds, she runs the gamut of human emotions. So she started out really exuberant and happy. But by the end, she started crying.
Oh,
but when
wow.
she got to rusted, she's like choked up. I don't know why. No one did, but it threw everybody for a loop. I mean, we messed up the take. In fact, it's supposed to be your tin roof rusted. Boom, love set.
Yeah.
But we came in wrong, and we spent all day trying to fix it. And we never got a better take than the first one. Because whatever that story was, whatever that meant to her, it got communicated somehow in a way that transcends the boundaries of conversational language or whatever tin roof rusted means. There's something going on there that really registered with people. And that's the allure. You want to make music that where the story gets under your skin.
Yeah. And you can't pinpoint it either. You can't make it happen. It's not.
You really cannot. No.
No. There's got to be a little bit of magic dust in there too.
You know something? I get nervous before every session I do. Doesn't matter if it's Bob Dylan
or... You get nervous.
Oh, terrified. Because, well,
terror
is strong. Yeah, no, I get butterflies in my stomach. Because here's the deal. You can learn how to make the room conducive to creativity. You can make sure that the microphones are set up and that someone's ready to press the record button at any moment. But you can't make that indescribable thing happen. That the magic happened. I'll liken it to surfing. You can learn how to stay up on the board. You can learn how to enjoy the ride, but you really don't control the ocean.
And you never will.
And you never will. So you never really know where the magic's going to come from, the thing. And you don't want to making good records. I mean, that's easy, but that's nothing. You don't want to make. They have to be great or they shouldn't be made, you know. So there's something... extracurricular that goes on.
That's the best explanation I've heard yet. I feel so privileged to be able to talk to you about these things, Don.
It's lovely.
You've worked with everything that we know, you know. It's it's really quite extraordinary, your catalogue. Your scope, and it's limitless. We'll quickly get on to Bob Dylan and what he's taught you.
Okay.
But you've presented an Outlaw Country show on radio. Mm-hmm. You've produced contestants on American Idol.
I did.
You made that beautiful documentary on Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys.
Yeah. Oh,
I just wasn't made for these times.
Yeah.
That was really very popular here in Australia and really
I didn't know that.
Resuscitated his career. I mean,
wow,
is there nothing you can't do, Don Ross?
Yeah, there's a whole lot. We won't get into it right now. But
but yeah, it's your scope is limitless. Is that the key to maintaining the enthusiasm, staying present in what you do?
Well, staying present, I think you just hit on it. You know, I'll tell you something. I've been playing this year with Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead. We have a trio called Bob Weir and the Wolf Brothers. I'm playing string bass. Bobby plays guitar and sings. Jay Lane plays drums. We've done about 50 shows in the U.S. in the last 6 months. And I initially took the gig because knowing what I know about the improvisational nature of the Grateful Dead and how they stretch out and never play the same show twice, yeah. I wanted to work on annihilating fear and self-consciousness and to getting into that zone where you can make music without thinking, where the conversation's just going on and you're not distracted, and you're not overly focused, you're not thinking. It's just, you just become the song, you become the story. And I wanted to do it not just to be a better musician, I wanted to apply it to other areas of my life. But I really think that being present and not distracted is the key to everything. You know, one time I read an interview with Frank Sinatra, and he was at the time he was making a movie during the day and then going to a studio, probably going to Capitol Studios at night and recording an album. Then he'd jump on a private plane and go to Las Vegas and do a midnight Rat Pack show, then repeat that the next day. I said, "How do you do all that?" He said, "Whatever you're doing, just be 100% there. Don't worry about what happened in the past. Don't worry about the future. Don't be afraid of anything. Just give 100% where you are." That's a pretty good way to
That's good advice. That's brilliant advice. Thank you, Don Woods. It's fantastic. There's so much more I could ask you, but just quickly, I imagine working with Bob Dylan had many challenges and wonderful blessings and wonderful experiences and difficulties. What is working with somebody like that give you as a producer? What do you learn from someone like Bob?
There's so much to learn from Bob, and it really wasn't that hard. It wasn't that he's a lovely guy.
Yeah.
He's always been super nice to me, and he's my hero. You know, that if you think about it, you take any one of his great songs, whether it's Times They Are Changing or Gates of Eden or Tangled Up in Blue, any one of them. If you just wrote one song like that in your lifetime, you'd go, wow, I did that, right? He's got 600 that are all on that level. There's no one who's that prolific and that consistently great. He's an absolute genius. And it was an eye-opener to watch him work because he's all about feel. It's not some cerebral thing. It's like John Lee Hooker. It's all about feel.
Okay.
And I'm glad I got that opportunity early on. I worked with him for the first time in 1989. And that was a good lesson in...
Were you green?
Was I green?
Yeah.
I was too green. I could have done a better job. But what are you going to do?
Oh, look, you're not green now, that's for sure. And it's just lovely to spend a moment inside your head and hear your hear your experiences, because they're wild compared to most of us. They really are.
I guess.
It's just your life. It's normal.
Yeah.
Completely normal. I'm going to end with a track that I think encapsulates what you do, which was sort of postmodernism before postmodernism. You were cutting and pasting even with artists before anyone was doing that. Mm-hmm. And this particular track I loved, Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh.
with Kim Basinger on this track.
Kim Basinger, yes.
And Shake Your Head, because you've always put artists together in interesting ways, haven't you?
This was an unlikely combination for sure.
And it was a hit here in Australia what was Ozzy like to work with? Ozzy Osbourne, he famous for those who might not know for biting bats' heads off, but he doesn't do that anymore. He just has cups and tea.
I love him, man. I've kept in touch with him. I haven't seen him like in the last year, but I stay in touch with him, and I think he's actually a really good guy.
Yeah. Don Woods, thank you so much for your
time.
Thank
you, man. It's a gasp.